Somebody's got to get started. I had a question for Christoph Bruch concerning the current policy and vision within Alliance and beyond Alliance. Is your current scenario a one in which eventually savings could be made or should be made for the benefit of research and science? Or do you work with the hypothesis that increased budget would be necessary? I didn't introduce myself, Brandstein, Strasbourg.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. It's a really important question, and there's no easy answer. What I didn't actually mention in my talk is that even though we have this wonderful priority initiative, that was the blue slide, that wonderful priority initiative, digital information, the group that is sitting together, or the various groups that are working together there, they don't negotiate contracts together. We have one example for a common negotiation based on the cooperation within the priority initiative, and I mentioned that on the slides, but I didn't say it. We call them the alliance licenses, and it's actually a straightforward subscription, a contract, but the special thing about it is that on top of the access, some green rights were negotiated to go with it. So based on that experience, there is right now some consideration to maybe go for a big deal. And of course, what's happening or has happened in the Netherlands is something we're looking at. Now, at the forefront of the developments concerning that is Max Planck Society. And I'm sure that many of you are aware of the publication from the Max Planck Digital Library, about 3 months ago. They claim we can save money. And of course, looking at the profit rate of the publishers, we know that at least in theory, we can save money. So whether we will actually be able to save money, and I shouldn't say that because I'm supposed to talk about that on Wednesday, will of course depend on how we negotiate. And the key question here is there a scenario in which we do not conclude a contract if we are not happy with what is being offered? And as of now, I don't see that the scenario or what we've been seeing in the Netherlands or in Austria is an answer to that. You know, they got a first deal. But getting a first deal that may be fairly good doesn't mean that this is the right way forward. I'm not saying it's the wrong way. I'm just saying we have not proven yet that it's the right way. I'd like also to point to the project Scope 3. I guess many of you are familiar with the project Scope 3. They negotiated sort of a switch of, I think, 6 or 8 journalists. It's a very small project from that respect. They negotiated to pay a lump sum to the publishers of these journals in high energy physics. For that lump sum, the publishers agreed to at least publish a certain amount of articles. Now, this has been going on for 2 years now, and the publishers published a considerable amount more than they were obliged to publish. Now, one could say, great, we paid a certain sum, and they didn't publish X number of articles, but X plus, so we got a good deal. Now, the publishers say, well, based on what we've published in the last 2 years, when we go for the second leg of that contract, we, of course, have to increase what you pay because we published more articles. Now, from that logic, we're going beyond the price increases you're used to, because now price increases are based on an extension of the number of articles. That has not been addressed by these other contracts, and I think that's a big challenge. Sorry for talking so long.
In fact, it certainly is the most surrealistic situation that we've ever seen in a university forever. And I still do not understand. Yes, I do understand that we are taken as hostages by our own researchers, because that's where the problem is. And so my view on this, and I don't know how much you share that, but my view on this is that we have, the first thing we have to do is to bring our researchers and university leaders to consciousness, to realize where the problem lies and how much it costs. Today, our researchers don't care about how much we pay for documentation. They don't even know that how much we pay, if we pay, and so on. So that's really where the problem is. And when I hear that different organizations are trying to deal to reduce the cost with a corporation that cannot decrease the cost because it is a business and they have stakeholders and they must bring dividends to their stakeholders. And not a single one of them is going to say, okay, we are going to reduce our benefits to half of what they are. It does not exist. And so I think this is the most strange, schizophrenic situation where we all are intellectuals and we're all able to understand what's going on, and we cannot just grasp the problem where it is. It's amazing. It's really amazing. Okay, I will monopolize the microphone. Yeah.
Perhaps a brief comment. I don't think it's only that researchers are taking hostage. It's a catch-22. Researchers are in a system where they have to publish or perish, and universities have a career system that encourage them to publish. So that's the catch.
Yes, this is why I think you mentioned, Seibold, that the way that evaluation is being made is now on the few best papers, which is a big change as compared to publish, and republish many times the same thing.
Sorry, briefly, just another point. It was mentioned earlier on the big difference between the commercial publishers that have to please the shareholders and the societies, the learned societies, that basically also have to work with efficiency, make bonuses, but if I can say recycle the benefits for the society, for the researchers, by promoting conferences, grants for young scientists, etc. So the feeling, the perception by the scientists is very different. In one case, they work for free for commercial publishers that please shareholders. And when you see the margins, we're talking about 30 plus, and the salaries paid to researchers, they find the discrepancy shocking. If the money is made by societies helping the community by various means, conferences, program, etc., the feeling is very different. But I cannot think that we should start with the assumption that the massive benefit which are made by some commercial publishers are forever. I mean, some industries have disappeared because they could not adapt. So I think we just have to make it aware, make people aware of the situation. I fully agree with you. People don't know how much is spent on libraries, on journals, and exert the pressure. I mean, that was mentioned earlier. that the rule of the game. We have basically, I think, no alternative. I don't think it would be reasonable to try to go to the public, in other words, to the politician, and ask for more money at the time we want to rationalize a system that has completely exaggerated. I don't think this would be in favor of scientists. We can ask more money for doing research, but not to please shareholders.
And to comment on what you just said, the dinosaurs disappeared not because they decided to, but because the environment changed. And the only ones who can change the environment where the publishers live is us.
Okay. Just to elaborate on what you were saying, because in fact, it's like we are trapped in a kind of a very complex web of many things, because we, the scientists, as you know, of course, that the bibliometrics is made by the publisher, but now they have all these new tools like CIVAL, like Insight, Thomson Reuters, that they are selling to you, to you, because, I mean, people who are managing the scientific world and the researcher career. And because they pretend they sell you some tools to teach you how to see what your own scientists produce and publish. And I have myself witnessed the way they talk to you. And it's absolutely disgusting. And a lot of you, Bernard Rontier, you are, of course, quite lucid. But many of your colleagues, I mean, I'm talking at managing level, they are not. They are very happy that they are just us. If you pay me some services, I will help you to do the management of your. And I think all this kind of intellectual laziness. I'm very sorry to say that. And by letting outsider to tell us what we have to do, should be attacked and denounced. And there are in this room people from the, for instance, from the French Academy, and myself from the European Academy. People in academy and in society, I mean, of course, all scholarly oriented society, we should denounce that and spoke out loudly. But of course, we are not well informed, and we are not working 100% of our time on trying to understand the system. We are trapped in it.
Yeah, of course.
But we need to know more about how it's working.
I would agree with that. At the same time, it's also important to use the opportunities we have. I mean, you were pointing out earlier to this copyright agreements. If we would really, if all the unions of professors would agree in Europe that we use our own standard copyright agreement that does not include waiving your copyrights, we are using a right we have, and we are using a position we have. Every 3 years, countries are negotiating these big deals. The last time the French were negotiating with Elsevier, it was all about data and text mining. But they started by signing the non-disclosure agreement, which meant that if you are negotiating to spend public money and you are telling yourself that you are not entitled to disclose the amount of money the French taxpayer is paying on this. This is not something about people on Mars or in Venus. This is something we do ourselves. So if you start in the next round of negotiation by saying, okay, this is public money, we will have to disclose every detail of it, like when we buy jets for the Air Force, or when we spend money on roads, mm-hmm. So we spend money on publications. We have to disclose all of this. So we are not allowed to sign this, not, and so on and so on. These are all steps that do not require a change of law, only a change of habitus of action ourselves on our own side of it.
Well, can I disagree on the very last sentence? We have to change the law. You know why? Because the reason why there is this non-disclosure clause is not due, I mean, the French negotiator, they cannot do anything, because it's in fact something which comes from a European law, which is then applied into French law as an exception to the, en français, c'est la loi des marchés publics. There is an exception to the law of public market, which is due to the protection of intellectual properties. And then it's because myself and other scientists who are given our intellectual property by signing the copyright agreement, that we then allow them to use this European directive in order that the contracts are non-disclosable. Back to the fact that it's completely systemic. And now, very soon, we are going to have Axelle Lemaire coming. And Axelle Lemaire, she's preparing a new projet de loi, very important. And there is Article 9 of this, where we should push that there should be the condition that we never give a non-exclusive, I mean, we should not never give the exclusive property, and we should make compulsory or make that even if I think by mistake, signed by mistake, under French law, it doesn't have value. And in fact, even today, it doesn't have value under French law, because French law, no, it's very complex. French law, we are author right law, okay? And, but when we sign the copyright agreement, we deal with copyright law. And under copyright law, this has, somewhere. Well, because under French law, you need to be compensated by money if you have this non-exclusive. Yeah. But therefore, are we strong enough to impose our French law at international level? And here there is an important point, because there are many other countries with author right law. Most of Europe, besides England, is in kind of author right law. Then Japan and Korea and Latin America. So if we join force, we can impose author right law instead of copyright law. But this is a major challenge where we need, I mean, it's not the scientists who can do that. No. They are the politician and they are you, the manager of science. And
That's where it has to go. And indeed, being a researcher is the only profession where you abandon your rights. No other human being does anything else than trying to conquer their rights, not give them away.
May I come back to the arguments of my colleague from Strasbourg? I totally disagree with you concerning learned societies. I don't think that you can make benefits on publishing, even if you give then these benefits to students or anything else. Publishing the works of research is a public property. It cannot be, you cannot make benefits on this. Okay.
I don't think you will agree on this, but
I think there is a slight misunderstanding. I mean, in Europe, for example, the Royal Society of Chemistry, maybe some disciplines are very special. I talk about that one because that's the one I know best, because I was on some councils. The publications make big money because it's very efficiently run, but the journal of the Royal Society of Chemistry are still per page amongst the cheapest on the market. So the money they make is used by the society for the benefit of scientists in various ways. I mean, if they were losing money on that, that would be really mismanagement. Okay? So I have nothing about good management, making profit. The question is, what do you do with the profits? I mean, a big organization has area where they make money and area where they spend money. The balance is at the end of the day has to be positive, otherwise you go bankrupt. But this is maybe very specific to some areas. Chemistry has been organized itself in Europe through various societies. It's a very lucky situation. Other disciplines could not get organized through European societies, for example, so easily. So that, of course, depends very much on the area. But in some areas, it works very well indeed. The American Chemical Society lead the market. This is a learned society. They make huge benefits from the publications, but they use that money, again, for the benefit of science. At least to a large fraction, I can't tell you the details of the numbers, but they're really leaders on the market. So it is possible for learned societies to really rule the game.
I totally disagree. I'm sorry, but it cannot be a market. Knowledge and the publication of knowledge cannot be a market.
C'est comme ça qu'on en revient à mon idée de base, qui est que rien de tout ça ne doit être commercial. Et c'est facile, puisque nous avons l'Internet, nous pouvons publier dessus, lire dessus, tout ça peut se faire parfaitement gratuitement. La seule petite difficulté, c'est le peer reviewing. Si on considère encore qu'aujourd'hui, en 2015, le peer reviewing vaut vraiment quelque chose. Mais j'ai souvent l'habitude de l'appeler le peer reviewing, P-I-R-E. Mais heureusement, il y a quand même encore des bons.
On en parlera demain.
On en parlera, oui. Ça, c'est très important qu'on en parle demain matin. Mais donc, le reviewing, l'évaluation de la qualité d'un article, c'est quand même pas le publisher qui le fait. Hein, donc, en tout cas, il le fait faire par nous. Alors pourquoi est-ce absolument indispensable que la valeur ajoutée passe par lui? Parce qu'il a un soi-disant reflet de neutralité, mais en tout cas, certainement pas sur le plan financier. Donc moi, je pense qu'il faut qu'on se débarrasse de cette engeance le plus vite possible.
Je voudrais juste illustrer par un exemple. On peut même dire un publisher très connu, on peut le dire, même Elsevier. J'ai la preuve, et je peux vous l'apporter, que quand, pour des raisons de marketing, je suis absolument du côté de Jacques, pour des raisons de marketing, ils veulent augmenter l'impact factor de leur revue. Donc, le peer reviewing est fait par le comité éditorial. Ensuite, quand c'est accepté, donc ça part chez le publisher qui se met en contact avec les auteurs à la fin pour signer le copyright, c'est une chose, mais ensuite corriger les proofs. Et au moment du proofreading, c'est le publisher qui demande aux auteurs d'ajouter plusieurs, dans les références, des citations de plusieurs articles des deux dernières années de la revue en question, simplement pour augmenter l'impact factor. Ça, c'est naturellement inacceptable, mais il faut savoir que c'est des pratiques de publisher pour des raisons de marketing. Ça existe. Et je vous donne les noms, si vous voulez. Je vous donne même le formulaire en question.
On est bien d'accord.
C'est parce qu'il y a une démarche de marketing. Et j'ai encore juste un tout petit point par rapport à le projet de loi d'Axel Lemaire. Il y a un passage très intéressant où il est défini, on essaie de définir dans la loi française la notion de commun informationnel. Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire? Un commun, ça veut dire quelque chose qui est utilisé par tout le monde, dont tout le monde a la jouissance, mais qui n'appartient à personne. Et je pense que les publications scientifiques doivent rentrer dans ce cadre-là.
Absolument. Ouais.
C'est quelque chose qui doit être fait pour être échangé. Parce que la valeur, justement, ce n'est pas du marketing, ça. La valeur, c'est dans l'échange. Alors que si on a une possession exclusive, naturellement, on donne de la valeur marchande, mais on empêche l'échange. Une idée, ça doit être échangé. Les articles, ça doit être échangé. Ouais. Un article qui n'est pas lu, c'est un article qui n'a pas de valeur scientifique. Il a peut-être une valeur économique, si vous arrivez après à jouer sur le prix de la rareté, mais il n'a pas de valeur scientifique.
Mais oui... on a encore du chemin à faire parce que demander à un certain nombre de jeunes quelle est la valeur de leur article scientifique et pourquoi ils publient, ils vous diront en numéro un pour mon CV. Et puis ensuite, éventuellement, pour communiquer avec d'autres. Donc c'est nous-mêmes qui instituons un système qui engendre cette plus-value sur les articles à haut facteur d'impact, même si on sait que ça n'a rien à voir avec l'article et ça n'a à voir qu'avec le journal. Bon, on ne va pas enfoncer beaucoup plus de portes ouvertes. Je pense que nous attendons l'arrivée de la ministre. Est-elle annoncée? Elle est annoncée. Voilà.
Ouais, c'est juste un petit commentaire par rapport à ce que vous avez dit tout à l'heure sur les présidents, on va dire, etc., qui ont l'impression d'être bien conseillés par les Elsevier avec des outils comme Sival, etc. Juste un commentaire. Moi, je m'étonne toujours en fait que des consortiums comme Couperin, des consortiums documentaires qui ont pour mission de négocier des ressources documentaires, acceptent de négocier des outils comme Sival et Insights. Et je trouve que voilà, c'est notre responsabilité aussi si les présidents écoutent les publishers.
I think we have every reason to be optimistic about the possibility of making a change by negotiating well, because we have so far never been negotiating well. We have been negotiating putting ourselves in the weakest possible position, only negotiating in terms of waiting till the final date was there, never putting any pressure, never using any of the rights we have, never using any of the privileges we have in the process of negotiating. I know this from the Netherlands, where we have been negotiating big deals for a very long period already, but I know it from colleagues in France, in Germany, in Spain, where exactly the same thing has happened. So we have still a lot of space to gain and a lot of wars to win. Exactly that. So that's why I'm optimistic. We have never been using our real forces, and we should do ourselves the pleasure of using our forces, join them, and play the game as you do this in the real world. Which means that we have to say goodbye to a lot of private and individual differences among ourselves. I mean, every discussion on open access leads to a variety of points of view. You have 5 or 6 in 5 minutes. And if you have a meeting like this, you have 100, like we just demonstrated. I mean, if I were a publisher, I would smile seeing this. And see, this is exactly what science and what academia is doing. They differ on any point. They have each of them individual strategies. Well, if trade unions were negotiating that way with the government or their employers, they would never get anywhere. And this is what we do in open access. Each meeting produces new instances of details and individualistic points of view. I have a private solution to the whole matter. I have another private solution to it. Well, this is only playing into the hands of the ones who have the negotiating power and who have concerted actions all around for a very long time already.
Oui, et c'est pourquoi nos négociations se font entre quatre yeux et sur une base de binôme chaque fois. Bien, je pense que nous allons accueillir Madame la Ministre.